Today is August 7th, 2013, and this is episode number 216 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, German provocateur. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you would like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
You know how badly I want to go there, and yet I'm restraining myself.
Fun with titles.
Yeah.
Well, so listen, we have actually a really packed show.
We do? Wait, we have topics. We have topics. We totally do.
We do. We have a ton of things to talk about. So how you doing? Things have been great. It's been a busy week. How about you?
Doing great. Lots of fun.
Wonderful. Okay, great.
Glad the German thing's working out for you.
Indeed. So let's get right to it and jump into the DOJ.
What do you think? All right, let's start with the DOJ. I couldn't figure out if you wanted to start there or if I was supposed to go, and that's 6 weeks Apple Context Machine. But I guess we'll do the DOJ thing, whatever.
We'll do that. So last week, the DOJ filed what it thought would be appropriate remedies to whip that pesky and evil Apple back into shape from its evil price-fixing ways.
I'm just so glad that the DOJ is there to take care of us.
Yeah, well, let me actually jump right to that point. Let me jump right to that point. I believe that there is a very strong role for government to take in antitrust issues. I believe that capital errs towards greater accumulation of power and wealth, and that a legitimate role of government is to regulate that and to keep too much power and too much wealth from accumulating in the power of too few hands in the form of monitoring and regulating the marketplace. You know, antitrust is a real thing. Price fixing is a real thing. This isn't just something that went away, you know, with the end of Standard Oil or with Microsoft no longer bundling and tying its web browser to Windows, right? I mean, this is real stuff. It seems like the DOJ has just wrongly fixated on the idea that consumer price is the only thing worth protecting, in particular in the publishing industry. And I think that that's where they've erred here.
I think focusing just on price is a big mistake, and I think it was actually pretty myopic of the DOJ, because the big issue here isn't price. It's how are these prices being controlled?
Yeah. How are these prices being controlled, and what's the end? You know, we got an interesting comment. I don't entirely agree with this comment.
And yet you're going to read it anyhow.
I am.
See,
going to read
Brian,
it.
You are a better man than many people give you credit for. That sounded awful. I'm really sorry.
It's fair. It's fair enough. Here we go. Windwalker, Yanks. I'm guessing he's British. I don't actually know. He said, so this is why you Yanks are so afraid and distrusting of your government institutions. There is no judgment or discernment anywhere in the system. People arbitrarily wield the letter of the law as a club to reach their career goals. There is no regard to the desirability of outcomes for society at large. Make no mistake, this is a direct consequence of who you are and what you value. Those are very sweeping statements, and I don't agree with them by any stretch of the imagination. And I also even the premise. I think that there is value in the rule of law, and that making subjective ruling subjectively is leads to its own corruption in and of itself. But in this particular case, I think he's got a point. The DOJ is just fixated on this price thing and not looked at the bigger picture of what's happening to the publishing industry and what was happening to the publishing industry when Apple entered the market.
Yeah. Okay, so I have several thoughts bouncing around in my head, and I'm hoping that I can keep them in some sort of order so I can actually get them all out of my mouth and into the microphone. I see this as a problem that the DOJ became so focused on the thing that they became focused on and missed the bigger picture, and in the end ultimately created what amounts to a government-sanctioned monopoly and government-sanctioned control, artificial control over the ebook market.
By Amazon.
Yes, by Amazon. Right. By Amazon.
Right. And the thing that sparked us to bring, we've talked a lot about this in recent shows for sure, and we're not going to delve deep into that again. But the thing that changed was the DOJ's proposal. The thing that's new, I should say, was the DOJ's proposal for fixing it. And from the standpoint of the DOJ, they want a conviction. So the DOJ wants to fix the problem. And, you know, so that's why I'm using that terminology. And their fix goes way beyond ebooks. They have basically proposed full oversight of all of Apple's iTunes business. That Apple cannot enter into any agreements. Basically, Apple can't use the Most Favored Nation clause, and it can't use agency pricing in any of its iTunes businesses. And I've got a huge problem with this because Apple hasn't even been accused of any wrongdoing in any of its other iTunes businesses. So I don't understand why even a conviction in the iBooks business, assuming that conviction holds up, which I personally doubt, I don't understand why they think that they should be able to get all this other control that will artificially hamper Apple and only Apple going forward.
Yeah, I'm really not doing well with wrapping my head around the way this whole thing has played out. And I agree with you. I think that on appeal, we will end up with a different story out of this. But right now, it's unfortunate, and I find it concerning because I think that if everything is allowed to progress as it stands today, consumers get screwed, which I don't believe is the DOJ's intent. I think that they really are trying to, on some level, protect consumers, but they're setting us up to get burned really bad.
Yeah, they're setting us up to eventually get burned, all in the name of competition. It's you know, really, I've been saying this since this case began that they're effectively restoring Amazon's power to gain and maintain monopoly power in the name of competition. And that's the part that's never sat well with me. It just doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. And at the risk of rehashing things that we have discussed before, I think the DOJ was off target. And I think that the court, even though we're talking about a judge that is very competent, I think the court ruled inappropriately in this case that Apple was colluding, because there's so much evidence to show that all of these companies were doing their own thing, and then they just ended up getting together at the end and striking the deals that they needed to strike.
Well, you know, the publishers may well have colluded, and I discussed this in the comments with some Apple critics in the piece I wrote last Friday. there's colluding and there's quote unquote colluding. There's price fixing and there's sort of the natural situation where competitors basically all arrive at the price that they're willing to accept for their goods, to, you know, where they think that any more cuts will not bring any benefit, and you know, and it's just sort of this mutually agreed upon price structure that doesn't have any, you know, even a handshake and a wink behind it. It's just where the market works itself out, and the book publishers do still compete with one another. You know,
right?
They do still have to sell their books against one another, and you know, the idea that they decided that books were either going to be $12.99, bestsellers were going to be $12.99 or $14.99. I don't know, man. This is show me where the real harm is being done.
I can show you where the harm is being done, but it's not where the government wants you to think it's being done. Where it's being done is through the artificially low prices that Amazon is selling books at right now. And I think that once they've managed to drive everyone else out of the market, then they will artificially raise their prices.
Yeah, maybe. But, I wonder, is that actually the case? Because I've long assumed the same thing, mind you. I'm not actually arguing with you. I'm throwing another point into the mix. Amazon has never raised its prices. Amazon doesn't make any money on anything. Right? Everything they do is at these razor-thin margins, and they make no profit. You know, Amazon is like a friend of mine, he said that no one's better at making money. How did he put it? No one's better at earning value by making no money than Amazon. You know, it's true. They have this enormous market cap of, you know, 100 billion or more. It's more than 100 billion. And they have a price to earnings ratio of something like, you know, 1300. Actually, right now it's infinite because they haven't made a profit in the last few quarters. You know, so
wow.
And they've already, the company's already put a lot of traditional, you know, it's already done a lot of disrupting, and yet it doesn't turn around and raise prices to eke out a profit, which has long been the thought of what they would do. And I know it's just weird. Maybe they would have continued to sell bestsellers at a loss forever in the name of market share. Maybe.
Well, once you have all the market share, and you have effectively locked everyone else out, why do you need to continue selling at a loss?
Well, you don't, and that's generally speaking the purpose of dumping. You know, the purpose of dumping is to put the competition out of business and then be able to rake in all the profits. That's the purpose of horizontal price control. That's the purpose of dumping. It's the purpose of tying and bundling. You know, that's generally speaking what businesses who are in that position seek to do. But again, Amazon has never actually done that, despite having achieved a lot of that disruption in multiple markets. And you know, the question remains when. You know, the reality is that when Barnes & Noble goes out of business, which to me seems
inevitable,
then might Amazon raise its prices? That would, you know, one would think. It's interesting. I mean, the reality is that Amazon tends to just suck all the profits out of any industry that they enter, and the result is that you get very poor service everywhere but Amazon. And as long as you're willing to accept an online shopping experience, that's fine. But you know, it makes it very difficult for buying shoes from someone who actually knows shoes. It's actually a much better experience than buying shoes on Amazon or buying shoes from someplace where you can't get anyone to help you. Or if you do, they're very poorly paid and not trained. And, but, you know, it's so hard to, like, the shoes that I like to wear, they're called BMTs or MBTs, Maasai.
That's so weird. I thought you were wearing the BLTs.
No. They're very expensive shoes. They make walking, especially for me, a big man, they make walking comfortable. You buy them in a shoe store, and they can be $200. You buy them from Amazon, they can be $139. And, you know, it's really hard to say no to that. And it's very hard for the retailers to be able to combat that kind of price discrepancy, especially when people will go in, shop, get fitted, and then turn around and buy them from Amazon.
See, that's a big problem for a lot of companies. Best Buy, the joke has been that Best Buy is Amazon's showroom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and that's because Amazon was promoting showrooming. They were promoting people to go in and
well, they have an app that's just for that. You go in. Let's see. Hold on. Grabbing my iPhone and looking now. Because okay, shopping. Yes, I actually have a category on my iPhone for shopping. Okay, Amazon Price Check app. Scan a barcode in a store, and Amazon tells you how much cheaper you can get the product buying it through them.
Yeah, there were multiple third parties that were offering their own similar apps as well.
Right, but right. I mean, yeah, Amazon, they've been strong-arming their way into so many markets anyhow, and giving us an app that lets us go use any store as a showroom for them shows us how much money we're going to save by buying through Amazon, but then also gives Amazon information about every single store we go into and every product we're interested in. That's so Google.
Of course. It is very Google and Facebook-y. But you know, there's so many things that Amazon does so well. Their warehouse efficiency is a modern marvel, and then some. And their shipping efficiency is amazing, and they have done some incredible work in understanding that if you want this, you might also be interested in this, that sort of thing, right?
Right.
And from those are all great for the shopping experience. You know, it's interesting. I don't want Amazon to go away. Amazon. I mean, you know, we have an affiliate program with them. I am an aspiring author, as I've mentioned a couple of times, and my assumption is that my book will one way or another wind up on Amazon. It's not that I have very complex feelings.
You're very deep, Brian. You're so very deep.
Or something. Yeah. I don't know. But this DOJ suit drives me nuts. It just drives me nuts. And the DOJ's remedy drives me nuts. It's overreaching. It is draconian. It is punitive in a way that far outweighs the problem that is supposedly being remedied. I mean, the reality, the problem was remedied when the publishers settled, and that settlement included the fact that they can no longer do agency pricing, and they can no longer do most favored nation clauses with anybody, including Apple. Right, that actually solved the problem, which is separate from whether or not Apple needs to be punished. But this oversight of all of iTunes, to correct a problem that Apple hasn't been accused of, let alone convicted, and then to correct this other problem that has already been solved by other settlements, that to me is just branching into wrong.
How many businesses has the government decided they needed to manage, and that's worked out well?
Several. AT&T. Standard Oil. There's been a lot.
That's okay. Yeah.
There are a lot of.
Thanks for totally ruining what I thought was going to be an awesome point. But you're right.
Yeah, several. How about the pollution? You know, the pollution industry. That is. We are not swimming in acid rain because of government regulation. I mean, there's plenty of role for government to regulate industry and to regulate the environment.
All right. So what I'm seeing really isn't so much the regulation part out of this. In this case, it feels more like actual business management.
Well, yeah. So the way it would work is that there would be two positions. I got to remember it now. There would be the antitrust compliance officer who would be on the board, and then there's the antitrust. Is that true? I don't know if he's on the board, but it's an officer within the company. And then there's the antitrust compliance monitor who reports only to the board and only to non-executive board members. So, in other words, just trying to not have the Fox ruling the hen house is the point of that. Both of those positions would be paid for by Apple, but they would not report to the CEO. So Tim Cook would not be able to fire them, and again, to keep the fox from ruling the hen house.
Sure.
So it's not like the DOJ would be, you know, would have an office of the, you know, an office of Apple set up. It's just that they sort of get oversight over a lot of contractual decisions, and so it's not direct oversight. But it's effective oversight.
Yeah, I'm not doing well swallowing that pill.
I'm not either. The punishment doesn't crime, and you know. And again, I really think Apple. You know, the reality is the current Supreme Court sides with Capitol far more often than not. And I expect them. Of course, you know, there are two capitals here. There's Amazon and Apple. They both represent capital, but Amazon technically isn't part of this case.
Right.
So really, it's capital. It's the DOJ versus capital in the form of Apple.
Right.
And this Supreme Court is very, very capital friendly. And that's assuming that Apple loses at the appellate level, too.
And they may not.
They may not, yeah. And yep. And the judge hasn't accepted the DOJ's remedy. And also, it is the DOJ's job to ask as much as they can get, and just from a human negotiating standpoint, in some ways, to ask for more than they want, so that when it gets cut back, it's what they want. That's a negotiating reality.
Yeah, and that's a pretty common negotiating tactic.
And, you know, the judge hasn't agreed to any of this stuff yet. Apple, of course, protested.
Of course they did. It didn't matter what the DOJ said.
Yes.
Apple was pretty much obligated to file a protest.
Right. And that's the flip side of the DOJ's coin. You know, Apple can't find anything that the DOJ proposes to be reasonable because they want to get as much out of it on their side.
Right.
So, all right. That's tons of fun, isn't it? By tons of fun, I mean a big mouth.
Tons of fun. I just feel all happy and warm and fuzzy inside now.
Mm. Oh, speaking of fuzzy and warm inside, I've got an idea for a new feature on the show.
I'm a little creeped out, but okay. Because I don't know where warm and fuzzy is going in this case.
Well, it's my usual lack of, you know, of a good sequitur.
Exactly.
We had a couple of things come up this week that didn't warrant a full segment of the show, but we thought that we could still have a few things to say about them. So I was thinking,
that's so funny
sort of
how you think
fire.
We'd have something to say.
I know, isn't it?
Yeah. Rapid
so I
fire.
We'd do
I think that's
like a rapid
great.
Fire session.
Cool.
Just like we've never talked over each other as much.
No, we. people are going to wonder what's really going on. The real Jeff and Brian, they'll be back next week.
This is Anthony and Thea right now.
That's right.
Good old Ainsley and Sierra.
Yeah.
Best interns ever.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you let the interns run the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really hope Jeff and Brian aren't pissed off when we untie them and let them out of the closets. They'll be okay with that, don't you think?
I wouldn't count on it. I think there's a really good chance that we could get fired, but it's totally worth it.
I don't know. I think they'll both be really nice about the whole thing. They seem like nice fellows.
All right, let's do our rapid fire. First one, let's talk about the Misfit Shine.
Yes. Okay, so the Misfit Shine is a new wearable fitness tracker, like a Fitbit or a Nike Fuel Band, you know, one of those type of things. But it just looks like a little aluminum disc, and it does the same things that other fitness trackers do. Tracks your steps, your flights of stairs you're taking, all that stuff. Can track your sleep patterns. What I'm finding very compelling about this, and I'm hoping to be able to get my hands on one so I can really see what it does, it's all aluminum, including the surface that shows you information. And what they did, and this is just like so cool, they laser drilled these little micro holes through the surface of the aluminum face so that light can shine through, but water can't pass through. So that means this is also... Yes!
No.
Yes.
No, they did not do that.
They totally did that.
Huh.
So, yeah. So light can pass through. Water doesn't. You can swim with it. If you accidentally run it through the wash, that's not a problem.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The what? You run it through the...
I hate you.
Do you hear that when you say that? I'm just curious.
No, I hear your mocking and disdain. That's all that I hear.
No, I know, but I didn't start the mocking and disdain until after you said wash. When you say like when I say wash, does it sound to you weird? Like, why are you mispronouncing that word?
No, it sounds
not,
fine.
At this point, I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm actually really curious.
No, it sounds fine. And when
interesting.
And I don't hear any difference when I say the word.
Interesting. That's so interesting to me. And this is, of course, your Missouri upbringing.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Ooh, Missouri upbringing.
Yeah. Just so you know, for your mispronunciation, there are two men waiting outside the studios right now. It's been great.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, it is. Well, let's get through this episode, and then I'll deal with them. So anyway, so if you run it through the warsh, it's okay.
Yes. And it's yes. I am so tempted to ruin our family friendly rating on this show.
The things you're not saying, I'm so proud of you.
Oh my God, you have no idea. I'll draw you a picture later. anyhow, so it's also designed so that you can attach it to different things like wristbands or necklace or belt clips, so that you can wear this in ways where it becomes part of your wardrobe in a in more of a fashion sense, as opposed to clearly visible technology hanging off your body.
That is really cool. Now, I thought there was something else that was really cool about this, and that's the fact that it's John Sculley's company.
Yes, he's one of the co-founders.
And it's one of the co-founders that was launched the day that Steve Jobs died. I've not been able to figure out if that was happenstance that they are trying to capitalize on, or was done deliberately in tribute. They sort of say it was done in tribute, but I'm not.
Well, the Misfits name was done in tribute to Steve Jobs.
Okay,
because of the
referring, of course,
the Misfits,
to the Crazy Ones.
Yeah,
yeah, the Crazy Ones ad. So it's John Sculley's company, but this product is actually in Apple stores.
Yeah,
and I wonder if that would have happened with Steve Jobs in control, because Steve Jobs, you know, Scully was
that man
dead
could hold him. A grudge.
He could hold a grudge, yeah. And, you know, once he writes you off, you were written off. And I really wonder if, you know, it's one thing for the Nest to have come in, because I don't think that Tony Fadell left under bad blood, with bad blood.
I don't think so. Certainly not the way John Scully left.
Well, yeah, John Scully, yeah, right. And, of course, John Scully was seen as instrumental in getting Steve Jobs, or, you know, creating a situation where Steve Jobs quit Apple, right. You know, before he could get fired. Right. And then, of course, eventually running Apple in such a way that it became a big
disaster.
A disaster, right. So he was, you know, in an 83, out by 93. The company grew a lot, but you know, he's often mocked. You know, I personally think that his Knowledge Navigator stuff was really interesting. Newton was really interesting.
Yes.
And so I give him a lot more credit than some of his critics, but I wonder if this product could have been in Apple stores with Steve alive. And I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know. It's possible, but I could see where Steve would have really put his foot down. Well, wasn't it Wiley's books got pulled from all Apple stores because Steve didn't like one of the books?
Icon.
That's right. That's right. He didn't like Icon. So
didn't Icon. So all of the Dummies books got pulled out of Apple stores. This is when the Apple stores really don't sell books anymore. But they continued to sell books for several years after this happened. But Wiley's books and all the Dummies books were not there. And yeah, you know, there's been lots of little things like that where Steve had put his foot down, and yeah, so it's it is curious. So that happened, and we also had the oh my goodness, where's our list? Oh, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post.
Yeah, I think I totally figured it out. It's one of two things. He misunderstood how you pay to get around the paywall.
So basically, he bought the Post for $250 million because he thought he needed to be able to read the articles.
Yes, and the other thing.
Yes,
that,
okay, that's a good idea.
The other thing I've heard
theory
is he has an intern as an assistant, and when he said that he wanted to buy the Washington Post, they didn't realize he meant just a single issue.
I like that. That is that's is that yours?
No.
Is that your joke?
Oh. No.
Golly gosh. I wish it was.
Let's edit the show so that I'm saying, yes, it was, Brian.
Okay, good. That's a good idea. Perfect. All right, so this is really interesting. So here we have Jeff Bezos, the CEO, founder of Amazon, springing $250 million on a newspaper, an industry that is largely seen as being in trouble. Of course, industries that are in trouble are the ones that are most ripe for disruption. Now, it's kind of interesting, like, is Jeff so all this criticism that I have of Amazon and its business model should not be mistaken for dismissal of Jeff Bezos as a genius, brilliant businessman who has disrupted time and time again and has shown that he will keep disrupting. And he's got a lot of different hats that he wears. He's got a lot of different things that he does. And almost all of them are successful, and that is amazing.
Yes, and it's important that people understand that Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post is not the same thing as Amazon owning the Washington Post. This is something he did, not Amazon.
Right, and he's not going to, seemingly, at least so far, he's not going to be involved in the day-to-day operations. He kept the publisher, kept the president, kept the editor of the editorial page. He kept most of the top people.
Right. And he told people that that he has a day job, so he doesn't need to be running a newspaper as well.
Right. So, and I don't expect him to. My first thought was like, oh my goodness, is he doing this just, you know, like almost like a charity? Like he doesn't really care if it loses money. You know, he believes in the newspaper industry, and he wants to actually make sure that a newspaper can be successful, especially the Washington Post, which does what I think is a very important job of covering Washington politics. You know, and it, maybe Jeff Bezos thinks that that's important enough to support. I mean, it doesn't really seem likely that he would consider it a charity. It seems a lot more likely that he thinks that there is a way to make money and to actually be profitable with this. And it's also possible that he's looking at some kind of Amazon tie-in, even though he's buying this with his own money, because Amazon is a publisher. They have a book publishing business in addition to the retailing business. And
they have a lot of periodicals that are available through Kindle.
Yeah. They retail a lot of stuff there too. So yeah, it's an interesting development. I've seen lots of really smart people offering their opinions on why he did it. I don't know that we've seen the right interpretation yet, and we may not for a while.
Yeah, I think this is something where we're going to have to wait and see what happens before we can figure out what his intentions really are.
Yeah, but it's really interesting.
Yes, it is.
Really interesting development. All right, and then our last rapid-fire topic is iOS 7 Beta 5 was released yesterday.
Yes, it was. And luckily, there's a lot of people out there that are more than happy to share information. So we have a taste of what you can expect out of this.
Yeah, and so the first thing is that it was released a week and one day after Beta 4. But Beta 4 was delayed by a week because it was released 3 weeks after Beta 3, and that was because of the developer site shutdown that Apple did.
Right. But it also – there could be two things happening here. First, they had the delay because of the dev site shutdown. But also, as we get closer and closer to the actual public ship date, betas start coming out in shorter and shorter intervals. So
that is true. I think beta 6 will probably be 2 weeks though, or a week. You know, a week and 6 days.
Maybe, or we might start getting weekly updates.
Yeah, that is very possible. And to that point, everything I've seen on beta 5 is it is head
it
and
seems
shoulders
much
faster
more fluid.
And smoother. Yeah, it's faster and smoother. Application switching, scrolling, Spotlight. We had someone write in and tell us that Spotlight was now a lot snappier. It has a little animation to go with it. Still making little tweaks. Like the biggest aesthetic change was a new set of icons for the settings app.
Right.
So it went from all blue and white to a mix of colors that should, in theory, make it easier to differentiate between which set of settings.
I think that's going to help a lot because the whole thing with the monochromatic interfaces, I think it makes it very difficult for people to single out the items that they need. And you can see just what a pain this is when you look at the sidebar in Finder Windows and at the library list in iTunes.
Right. And let's see what else did we see in it. One thing that we haven't seen is any change whatsoever to iBooks, coming back to iBooks. It's still the same old app as it was in iOS 6, same completely skeuomorphic interface, same bookshelves, the wooden bookshelves with the books sitting on them, the page turning, which I actually love the page turning. I hope that doesn't go away.
Yeah, having gratuitous skeuomorphism, I don't like. But when it serves a legitimate purpose, like I think the page turning really does, because it gives a very nice visual cue.
The skeuomorphism in page turning for reading books is the poster child for skeuomorphism being a good thing. You know, having a reel-to-reel tape player for podcasts, that's probably not so much. The leather stitching on the calendar, we can let that go.
But yeah, like the leather stitching didn't waste nearly as much screen real estate as the reel-to-reel thing did.
Right, that's true.
So it was more tolerable. But having it go away, I'm fine with that because we don't have infinite screen sizes. So let's optimize the space we have.
Right. God, you know, I wonder what Apple's going to do with iBooks in the face of is it at all possible that the reason why we haven't seen any changes in iOS 7 betas in iBooks because of the DOJ court case? I doubt that, since iOS 7's been in development for a lot longer than that verdict was expected. But it's anyway, this is supposed to be rapid fire.
For us, Brian, it is.
Yeah, it is. So iOS 7 is progressing very, very nicely, very quickly. Beta 5 is seems to be really, really good. Looking forward to seeing what else comes out of it. Think it's just really shaping up beautifully.
It is. And everything that I've seen, I am really looking forward to the official release.
Mm-hmm. You too. All right, let's move on to our last topic, which is all the IDC stuff that has happened in the last few days.
That's been kind of an adventure. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the first thing we had was the import ban on iPhones.
Right. This was an import ban that was handed down by the ITC to Samsung against iPhone 4s that ran on AT&T's network and iPad 2s that ran on AT&T's network. And I think the iPhone 3GS, but you know they don't even sell that anymore.
Right.
So it was an import and sales ban in the U.S. because those devices supposedly violated a Samsung patent. And then on Saturday, that was supposed to go into effect on Sunday.
Right. Then Saturday, the White House vetoed the ban.
Yeah, U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman throughout the ban, overturned it, vetoed it, which is effectively a White House action. I doubt the president was involved. It's hard to actually know, but it doesn't matter. It was a White House action. And he threw it out on the grounds that Samsung was trying to use a standards essential patent to get an import ban, and in particular the terms that Samsung was trying to get, including forcing Apple to license its non-essential patents in order to get a license for the standard essential patent, that was a problem. And this is in keeping with comments from the DOJ and the FTC and the White House itself being concerned about the way standard essential patents are the way companies are trying to leverage those.
And I think that concern is justified.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Make no bones about it. Samsung deliberately asked for terms that it knew Apple would refuse because they were unfair, unreasonable, and discriminatory. The opposite of fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory. Because by Apple refusing those terms, Samsung could then turn around and sue over that and try to use those standards essential patents as ammunition to fight where they knew they were infringing on Apple's non-essential patents. So it was all very deliberate. Same thing with Motorola.
Of course it was. Yes.
It was a deliberate tactic, and it's nonsense. And no regulatory body and no court has granted Samsung, Motorola, any success in this tactic, except for this one ITC ruling, which has been overturned.
Yes. Okay. And ITC rulings that have been overturned. That's the other thing that happened. And that was on Wednesday morning, U.S. Court of Appeals overturned an ITC ruling that had invalidated two of Apple's really big multi-touch patents. And
right.
Yes. And so when they did that, it killed a patent infringement case that Apple had going with Motorola Mobility. When the ITC ruled. So when Apple appealed and then was able to win their appeal today, those patents are considered valid again. And that means Apple can now move forward to try and get an import ban and sales ban on certain Motorola Mobility Android-based smartphones. And that actually has really big implications overall, because the problem relates in many ways to the way Android handles multi-touch. So it goes back to Google. So Google could find itself in a position where it's having to dramatically recode the way the interface works.
Yeah, find a workaround.
Yeah. And then we have all these other companies that are making Android phones that may have to scramble to get their products to not infringe on these patents. So this could have a huge impact on the Android market in general. And it also means that patents that Apple had pulled from its second infringement case with Samsung can be brought back in.
So the original ITC case can progress, or is Apple strictly in the court systems for these particular patents?
I believe it's a mix, because the Samsung case is in the court system. The Motorola case, I believe, is still ITC. There's so many cases, it's hard to keep track of where each one is anymore.
With the White House veto, the ITC situation is over. Right? Samsung is free. As a matter of fact, Michael Froman said Samsung is welcome to pursue its infringement claims in courts. Here's the deal. Apple... likely, I don't know this for sure, but this is my feeling on the issue. Apple is fine for these standards essential battles to be in court. Some of them are an issue of exhaustion. Some of them are where Samsung is trying to get an additional license from Apple for some kind of technology. And in this case, it was like code. It was like a very tiny, tiny bit of code used in underlying radio processors. Mm-hmm. And Apple is already covered by the license that, in this case, Infineon had. And, right. You know, Samsung has been trying to double dip with this stuff because it's all they had to fight Apple, like I said earlier. And in some cases, they're legitimate standards essential patents that Apple does need to license. But Apple wants to do it. But they're supposed
to be available under fair terms.
Yeah, and Apple wants those fair terms. My assumption is that Apple is happy to license the patents that are not covered by exhaustion on fair and reasonable terms. And Samsung and Motorola both just need to offer those fair terms, and they need to give up this losing strategy.
I agree.
That's what they have right now. It's a losing strategy.
And Apple has said as much, even if they haven't used the exact words that you have. But they have at least implied that no, I believe in the case of Samsung, they've come right out and said, look, you know, we wanted to have a reasonable deal for these patents, but Samsung wouldn't agree to it. So here we are.
Right, and Samsung screams loud and clear that Apple is refusing to negotiate, and that the evidence doesn't seem to back that up. The evidence is that Apple has been seeking for in terms and that Samsung hasn't offered them.
Right. And that's part of what makes the White House veto and the statements that went along with that veto important. Because the message that's coming out from that is, look, everyone that's playing this game has standards essential patents. Everyone knows we're supposed to be licensing those to competitors under fair terms. And this whole thing about using the standards patents to strong arm higher licensing rates out of your competitors isn't going to fly.
Right. And we should probably briefly explain that too. The problem with FRAND, fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory, is that that's not codified. There's no booklet of FRAND terms.
Yeah, where, it's like saying be nice.
Yeah, exactly. What the heck is nice? You know, we sort of all understand it, and but you know, it's not. It, but it's, you know, it's sort of like by mutual agreement. And this is the same thing with FRAND. There's sort of a, you know, basically a mutual agreement on what people, what companies are going to pay to license these technologies. And that's what Apple is looking for. They're looking for those FRAND terms. And what has happened with the explosive growth of the iPhone, which came in and like upset everybody's existing business models, is, and Apple was making these enormous profits out of it, that there was not only this opportunity to try to fight Apple's claims of infringing non-essential patents, there was also maybe just like, you know, I want some of that money too for no other reason than you're making it. And that's what the regulatory bodies have been upset about. And that's what the courts have been upset about. And that's kind of what's at stake here. And the notion of Samsung being able to get 600, 700, 800% of what everybody else is paying is from Apple is not, it's not reasonable. And
it sure doesn't sound reasonable to me.
Exactly. And the courts can afford, and that's why this stuff belongs in the courts. The courts can basically enforce a license that Samsung has to accept and that Apple has to pay. And when the courts do that, more often than not, it's going to be really close to what those FRAND terms are.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, so for a company like Apple, that works out reasonably well. For a company like Samsung, they don't get what they wanted. Right. And it cost them a lot of money. Yeah.
You know, Samsung basically wants to be free to copy Apple's design and utility patents.
And then charge Apple for the privilege.
Then charge Apple for the privilege. And that's just not right.
I agree. And I think part of what works out in Samsung's favor in a case like this is that courts don't like vagaries, at least these types of courts. But FRAND is nothing but vagaries. So it's very difficult.
Right. And the courts aren't going to solve that.
Right. And of course, Samsung doesn't want the courts to solve that.
Well, no, but the courts can't enforce a codification of FRAND. I mean, it would be up to the standard settings bodies to establish any kind of codified FRAND thing, and I don't even know if that's workable. This stuff is so complex. We're talking sometimes thousands of patents that go into a single standard.
I can't imagine how that could be managed. It's just a headache beyond comprehension.
And you know, and if anything, you can look at what Samsung and Motorola have tried to do as an inevitable part of this process. You know, at some point, someone's going to overreach, and the industry, the courts, and the regulatory bodies will have to smack that overreach down. And, you know, what's going to end up coming up out of this is everybody's going to have a much better understanding for the future of how this stuff should be working. Everyone's going to be on the same page once this is said and done. It's still going to take a few more years. But, you know, this stuff will become established at some point.
Right. But in the meantime, it will be chaos and turmoil.
Yeah. Or at the very least, headaches.
Right.
So listen, there's one more thing. We were looking at iTunes. And we haven't had a lot of comments in a lot of reviews since we've come back in March to do regular shows again. And if you like or if you hate the show, drop a comment in iTunes and let people know what you think.
Yeah, if you like the show, remember, it's Apple Context Machine. If you don't, it's – what podcast do we not like right now?
Oh shoot. Oh man, it would have been so funny if we'd had something planned for that.
I know. It would have been awesome. we can edit out the stalls and
anyway, if we're not asking you to lie, we're just asking you to go drop a comment in. There's let people know what we're doing these days, and we appreciate it.
Yeah, because you guys rock.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we know listenership is way up, and so, you know, we appreciate that too.
Yeah, and I'm certain, absolutely certain, the reason our listenership is up is because Brian is so dapper.
Yes.
You're a looker.
Or something. Or it's my soothing voice.
And your stunning good looks.
My stunning good looks. Okay. All right. Well, before we get taken off the air for blatant lies, why don't you take us out?
Okay. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening, and feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamut at both places. And go to freshbrewtales.com. That's where I talk about all the crazy stuff I see happening in coffee shops.
And you can follow me on Twitter at TM O'Brien. That's Brian with a Y. I'm Brian Chaffin, also with a Y, on app.net. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. My personal blog is at geektells.com. And our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week.
You know, people do need to go check out your blog, because it's a fascinating read, seeing the whole process of writing a book.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
That you stay subscribed, you're supposed to say.
Oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah, stay subscribed, people. We love you. Blah, blah, blah.
See you online at the Mac Observer.